Start. So today we're going to be continuing the study of these ontological models. So I'm going to give you a few basic examples of ontological models that can reproduce quantum predictions. They are mostly sort of toy models which are useful for thinking about the structure of these theories. Then we're going to go on to, for the next couple of lectures, talking about what you might call no-go theorems, so properties that these models can and can't have if they're going to reproduce the quantum predictions. So today I'll talk about excess baggage, explain what that is in a bit, and contextuality. Okay, so just as a reminder, here was the definition of an ontological model that we gave last time. So if we have a prepare and measure experiment, then we need to specify an ontic state space, so the set of physical properties of the system that actually exist out there. Then for every preparation procedure, we're going to have a probability distribution over the ontic states, which is specified by that preparation. That's called the epistemic state. It is what we know about the state of reality given that we made preparation P. Then for every measurement, there's going to be a probability distribution over its outcomes that can depend on lambda. Okay, so the measurement device, it sees lambda and then chooses how to respond. So let me point out that there's no assumption of determinism going in here. The measurement device can respond stochastically in these models. Some terminology, often we think of this thing as a function of lambda for a particular m and k. When you're thinking of it like that, it's often called a response function. So it's how does the, specifies how does the measurement device respond given a particular value of lambda. Okay, and then these are the predictions in the operational theory. You predict an outcome for each choice of preparation and measurement, and if the ontological model is adequate, empirically adequate, then it has to reproduce those predictions when you marginalize over the states of reality. And finally, if this is an experiment which has a quantum model, then of course those predictions have to agree with the Born rule predictions for the particular density operators and POVMs that represent that prepare and measure experiment. Okay, so to just give some quick examples, first one is obviously we talked about Speckan's toy theory last time, just for a toy bit. If we just do it for a toy, single toy bit, then there are four different ontic states which represent these four boxes here. And then we have these six preparation procedures which correspond to these different probability distributions over lambda, as we had last time. And the response functions, well, we have three different measurements, each of which has two outcomes, plus one and minus one, and they correspond to these response functions. It's a deterministic theory, so the X measurement, for instance, if you're in this box and this box, it always returns the plus X outcome, and if you're over here, it never does, right? So you have those response functions. So that's all very straightforward, just to show you that it fits into the framework that we have. And if we just consider a single toy bit, then this also has a quantum model. The quantum model is just prepare spin states in the up, down, x, y, z basis, and measure in those bases, right? When you consider two toy bits, it no longer is equivalent to a quantum model, but for this case it is. Okay, this next one is probably the most trivial ontological model on the market. But it's important to see that you can frame the orthodox interpretation of quantum theory in which the quantum state and only the quantum state is real within this framework. So what's our ontic state space going to be? It's going to be the set of pure quantum states. We don't care about global phases, so it's convenient to set them to be the set of projectors onto 1D subspaces of some Hilbert space. That's the pure quantum states. When we do a preparation procedure, which prepares a pure state psi, and here I'm using the naughty notation where I'm using the quantum state here for the preparation, assume that we have a particular method of preparing psi. Whenever you do something like that, then the probability distribution is just a delta function, right? Lambda, which is a projector, is just the same as the quantum state that you prepared, right? Very straightforward. And then when we do a measurement m, which is of this particular POVM, then what are the probabilities? What are the response function probabilities? Well, they're just the quantum probabilities, right? So, you know, quantum states are real, and measurement devices respond as they do in quantum theory. It's very straightforward. So by construction, very trivially, if I integrate these guys over lambda, I'm just integrating over this delta function. So lambda becomes psi, this will become psi, and so you'll get the quantum probabilities. So that's how it works for pure states. Note that if you're preparing mixed states, then it will depend, what probability distribution you get will depend on how you prepare that mixed state. Right, so if I, say, have the maximally mixed state, I can prepare it as an equal mixture of plus or minus z or an equal mixture of plus or minus y. And those different pure states will give different distributions. Okay, so here's something only slightly less trivial. This is a model that was given by John Bell when he was trying to argue that it's always possible in principle to have a deterministic hidden variable theory. So remember, he was fighting at the time against people like von Neumann, who thought that they'd proved hidden variable theories absolutely impossible. So this is just a sort of trivial example to show that you can do it. So what do we do? Well, it's a bit like the previous model in that the quantum state is real. So the ontic state space consists of two pieces. So we have lambda one, which is just the quantum state as before. And then we also have the unit interval, right? So we have a line from 0 to 1, the real line from 0 to 1. And lambda 2 is some number between 0 and 1. So when you prepare a pure state, it's just as before. You have the state, the quantum state is the state of reality. But I haven't written anything over lambda 2 here. That means I have the uniform distribution over lambda 2. So lambda 2 on the unit interval is chosen uniformly at random. And because this is the unit interval, that means that the probability density is 1 everywhere, right? So that's what it looks like. So now, and this is typically done only for orthonormal basis measurements. That's the case that we're most interested in for this. You could do it for POVMs too. But suppose we have an orthonormal basis, which consists of d states if we're in a d-dimensional Hilbert space. Then what do we do? Well, the response functions are set like this, right? So you have this thing that lives on the unit line, and we just divide this unit interval into intervals which equal the probability, the quantum probability of each of those outcomes. Okay, and then the point is that because the quantum state is ontic, the response function can know what psi is, right? So it just, what it does is it just compute, you know, wherever you are on this line, it gives the corresponding outcome. So if you happen to be here, you'll get the phi 3 outcome. If you happen to be here, you'll get the phi 1 outcome, right? So the point is that these response functions are equal to 1 on this interval and for psi, and they're equal to 0 absolutely everywhere else. And that by construction is just going to give you the quantum probabilities because you're initially uniformly at random on this thing. And so what probability you'll get will be proportional to the length of the interval. So it's an extremely trivial model, but we will have a use for it later, probably. Okay, so here's a less trivial model. This is called the Cochin-Specker model. It was proposed by Cochin and Specker in 1967 as a counterexample to their famous theorem for the two-dimensional case, and we'll see that later. So this only works for a qubit, and that means that we can make use of the Bloch sphere representation. So we can think of state vectors as points on a unit sphere. So our state space is again really just the space of quantum states. It's just going to be a unit sphere, but we're not going to have a delta function distribution. So the lambda, that's a unit sphere vector, you shouldn't think of it as the same thing as the vector that's been prepared. It's a different unit sphere. So here's how it works, and I'll draw some diagrams in general. How do you compute the probability of lambda, which is a vector? Well, what you do is you compute the inner product between the state you prepared and lambda, dot product on the unit sphere. If that happens to be positive, right, this is the Heaviside function, so it's one only if this is positive, then you set the probability proportional to that inner product, and you need a factor 1 over pi to make that integrate to 1 when you integrate over the unit sphere. Okay, so that's the probabilities. The measurement outcomes are deterministic. If you're measuring in an orthonormal basis, which just consists of two states, then you check the inner product between lambda and the state representing the outcome. And if that's positive, then you return the phi outcome. And if it isn't positive, if it's negative, then you return the phi orthogonal outcome. Now, it's less easy to see that this reproduces the quantum predictions. You will prove that. I can't remember if it's a homework or tutorial question, but okay, it's a tutorial question. But let me give you a bit more intuition as to what that looks like. Okay, so what happens is if I prepare a state psi, then lambda is distributed. It's non-zero. Probability distribution is non-zero only in the hemisphere defined by psi, so the positive hemisphere for psi. And it's proportional to the inner product between psi and lambda. So it's proportional to cos theta, where that's the angle between those two vectors. And then the response function for psi just says, if you're in the same hemisphere as phi, return phi. If you're in the opposite hemisphere, don't return phi. So that's sort of geometrically what it looks like. And you should take care. Well, you guys know this, but you'd be surprised how many people forget. When you're computing integrals in the Cayesian-Speckle model, we're on the unit sphere. So everything's with respect to the measure on the unit sphere, uniform measure on the unit sphere. So in spherical polar coordinates, an integral d lambda means this. Okay. So bear that in mind when you're trying to prove these things. Okay. So what we're going to look at for the next couple of lectures is, no-go theorems for different properties that ontological models can have. So these are the things that we're basically going to look at. We may look at one more thing as well that doesn't fit into this. And these properties all fit into a nice hierarchy. Some of these equivalences, some of these things I will prove the connection. But probably not all of, probably won't have time to do all of them. So this particular diagram comes from a long review article that I wrote if you want to see this done in great detail. So the point is that these are all properties that an ontological model might have. And what you can show is that if you have one that's higher in the diagram, then you also have the one that's lower in the diagram. Now, some of these links, like these black ones here, they're fully general. That would apply in any operational theory you have. But these red ones and this blue one here uses a property that's specific to quantum theory, right? So you might not have these equivalences in an arbitrary operational theory, but you do in quantum theory because of some special property that quantum theory holds. So these red links require that your theory is what's called self-dual. And in the case of quantum theory, this is just the observation that phi is both a state that you can prepare and a member of an orthonormal basis that you can measure, right? So there's a one-to-one correspondence between states and measurement outcomes in quantum theory. So that's needed to prove these links. And this one, well, these things all have to do with a single system, and Bell non-locality has to do with systems in an entangled state. And so the way you get from here to here uses the property that Schrödinger called steering. which is that if I have a de reduced density operator that's part of some entangled pure state, I can generate any ensemble decomposition of that density operator by measuring the other system in different bases. So you need to use that to get from there to there. As I said, so this is where we're going. And so you might have thought, but you probably do think, you should think, that, okay, all we need to do is prove that ontological models of quantum theory have to be psiontic and maybe Cauchy-Speck and contextual, and then we've proved everything, right? That would be good, but unfortunately, it's a bit more complicated than that because this thing in particular, you can only prove if you make some additional assumptions about your ontological models. Whereas all the other things, you don't need to make additional assumptions. So if I tried to make the proof of the reality of the wave function my fundamental thing, then all of these other things would inherit that horrible extra assumption. So one of the reasons for being interested in proofs of the reality of the wave function, beyond just its intrinsic interest, is just it's near the top of the hierarchy here. So if we can figure out how to do something like this with very minimal assumptions, then we sort of get everything for free. So because we can't prove that with additional assumptions, it becomes interesting to prove all these other things. And in particular, I'm going to show you this excess baggage thing, and we will talk about the two types of contextuality today, hopefully. Okay, so excess baggage theorems. Let's look at that. So this is a term that was coined by Lucian Hardy here at Perimeter Institute. He coined the term ontological excess baggage to refer to the fact that even for a qubit, you have to have an ontic state space that's infinitely many ontic states. You might think, oh, that's not surprising. I mean, if you're the kind of realist who thinks, oh, it's obvious that the quantum state is real, then that's maybe not too surprising for you. But from a psi epistemic point of view, perhaps it is surprising. We know from quantum information theory that you can only reliably store and retrieve one bit of information in a qubit. In quantum computation and quantum information, we think of a qubit as being analogous in some sense to a classical bit. We think of it as some kind of a finite thing. Yet, if these realist models are true, it in fact isn't, right? It in fact contains an infinite amount of information in some sense. Just can't access it. Okay, so it's an interesting thing to prove regardless of whether you think it's surprising or not. So Hardy originally proved that this must be infinite, but it could have been countable according to his original proof. It's since been proven by Montina that it must have the cardinality of the continuum. And also, all of this is under the assumption that the predictions of quantum mechanics are reproduced exactly. Of course, in any experiment, you only verify that to some accuracy, epsilon. So if you relax that requirement and only say you have to be epsilon close to the quantum predictions, then you can get away with a finite ontic state space, but you can still prove that the number of states has to be exponential in the dimension of the Hilbert space. So what I'm going to do, because these things are, would take a couple of lectures to do properly, I'm going to give you Hardy's original result. If you want the references to other works, here are two review articles. This one is a review article which is designed to target the average everyday physicist, so not quantum foundation specialists. This is a more specialist article on which is specifically about the reality of the wave function. But all the references to this kind of stuff can be found in those review articles. Okay, so we're going to prove the excess baggage theorem, but first of all, I'm going to prove a useful lemma, which is, well, it's kind of obvious, but I'm going to prove it formally because we're going to use it over and over and over again. Okay, so let P be the preparation of some pure state, and M a measurement in an orthonormal basis that happens to include that, right? Then I'm going to define two sets, So for this particular preparation of psi, this set is just the support of the probability distribution, right? So these are the lambdas, which are given non-zero probability when you prepare psi in that way. And here is, actually, did I mean to say that? No, I didn't mean to say that. Yeah, that definition's wrong. Let me see if I can correct it on the fly. Nope. I think I can. Nope, okay. All right, I mean to say equals one there. That should be that in that definition. So it's the set of lambda such that the probability of psi given m lambda is equal to one. Okay, so it's basically the set of ontic states that give you, that will always give you the outcome psi when you make that particular measurement. Of course, if you measure it in a different way, measure some other basis that includes psi, this set might be different. So in principle, this can depend on m as well as psi, and this depends on p as well as psi. But for any such thing, the support of this probability distribution must lie inside this set. Okay, so here's the proof. If we reproduce the quantum probability for preparing psi and then checking whether you're in the state psi is one, that must be given by this in the ontological model. We know that this thing is non-zero only on this set, right? So I can restrict the integral to that set, and I have to get the same thing. We also know that this thing is non-zero everywhere on this set, and it integrates to one because it's a probability distribution, okay? And it's positive everywhere, okay? So if this thing were less than one on a set that was not measure zero, then this thing would have to be less than one because this integrates on its own to one, okay? So you can't have a significant, well, non-measure zero sets on which this is less than or equal to one. I'm kind of skirting around the thorny measure theory issues, and I'll just say this has to be equal to one on that set. You can do it more rigorously than that. So that means that this guy has to equal one everywhere on the support of the probability distribution, again, up to measure zero sets. So the support of any preparation that prepares psi has to be within the set of ontic states that give the psi outcome in any measurement that includes psi. Okay, that's a very convoluted way of saying this. Okay. So now let's prove the excess baggage theorem. So any ontological model that can reproduce the quantum predictions for orthonormal basis measurements on pure states in any Hilbert space dimension must have infinite ontic states. So let's assume by contradiction that that's not the case. Let's assume that there are n states in this set for some finite value of n. Now let's consider just a two-dimensional subspace of our Hilbert space spanned by two states, orthonormal states, let's call them 0 and 1, okay? And then we're going to construct m states that are like this, okay? So j runs from 0 to m minus 1, there are m of these things. That should be a big m down there. But how these look like on the Bloch sphere, here I have my 0 state, here I have my 1 state, they're orthogonal on the Bloch sphere, and these m states, they're all at an equal angle to one another around some great circle. And in particular, for m minus 1, if we ran to m, we would get the one that's orthogonal to psi 0, but we're running to m minus 1, so we get the one that's still an angle theta away. So the important point about that is that, first of all, we can choose m as large as we like. I can do this for different values of m. But also, all of these states are non-orthogonal and none of them are identical, right? So actually, all of the quantum probabilities between j and k are strictly less than one. That's what matters. Okay, so there are no two of these states that are, there are no two of these states that have inner product one. Okay, so now consider what happens when you prepare the system in the state psi j and measure it in a basis that includes phi psi k, where j and k are not the same. Then, because the quantum probability is strictly less than one, in the ontological model, the probability, where this is a sum now because I made the assumption that lambda was finite, this sum is strictly less than one. So notice here again, I'm using the naughty notation where I'm, instead of writing p here, I'm writing the state. So here we're in a situation where you can imagine that there's only one way of, that we're only considering one way of preparing each state and one way of measuring each of these. So because of that, I will, the support of the probability distribution, I'll just denote lambda psi. Okay, so now, right, so this sum isn't equal, isn't one everywhere. Okay, now if this thing were one everywhere, right, so first of all, oh yeah, so the first of all, I should say, I can restrict this sum to lambda psi j, because that's the set on which this thing is non-zero. If I do that, if it were the case that this were equal to one everywhere on that set, then this whole thing would equal one, because this is a probability distribution, so that sums to one, okay? So there must be one lambda in that set such that the response function is less than one strictly. Otherwise, the sum would be one, okay? Now, since we proved that this thing is equal to one everywhere on the support of the probability distribution that corresponds to preparing psi k, that's what we proved in the lemma, this means that the supports of the probability distribution for psi j and psi k must be different subsets of the ontic state space, okay? Now this applies to every pair, right? So every pair, for every pair we have this. So every pair of quantum states in the set corresponds to distinct subspace, distinct subsets. So that means that there must be as many distinct subsets of the ontic state space as there are different states that we're considering. Okay, so what's the number of distinct subsets of a finite set? It's just 2 to the n. Go through every element of the set. Either the element is in your subset or it's not in the subset. So you get 2 to the n such sets, such possible subsets. So we know that the number of subsets must be greater than or equal to n, or in other words, n is greater than the log to the base 2 of n. But we could make m as large as we wanted, right, in this construction. You could pack these states as close as you like. As long as m is finite, you'll still have this. So what you can say is that n must be larger than any finite integer, right? And that's what we mean by n being infinite, countably infinite. So that's at least one way that you can prove that you must have an infinite state space. And because we also know from Montina's results that it must actually have the cardinality of the continuum, that means that we really can't get away, you know, we really can't get away with doing everything with sums over lambda, right? We really have to, if lambda's gonna be adequately model quantum theory, it has to be a continuum. We have to be doing integrals. Okay, any questions about that? All right, so now let's move on to contextuality. So I'm gonna follow an approach to contextuality that is due to Rob Speckens. Not everybody follows this particular approach, but I think personally think it's the nicest one. And a good way of motivating this approach is with Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles. It's a philosophical principle proposed by Leibniz. If you're not familiar with it, it basically says there are no no two distinct things that exactly resemble each other. Okay, so if two things are different, if two things are really different, then somehow they look different. This is arguably a very successful principle in physics. So it's something that we should treat seriously. So, for example, the idea that there's no preferred frame of reference in relativity. Well, there's no way of telling two frames of reference apart. There's no way of telling which one would be the fundamental frame. So the principle of relativity is arguably the way we don't introduce a preferred frame is arguably an example of that. Einstein's equivalence principle definitely is, right? It's like you can't tell, there's no experiment you can do to tell a difference between accelerating and being in a uniform gravitational field. So he says those are actually the same thing. So these are all examples of using this kind of principle. Another way of thinking about this principle is that it's sort of a no fine tuning argument. So suppose you have two objects, A and B. Suppose A and B are both sealed boxes, and one of them contains a particle and one of them doesn't. The particle, we suppose, has properties like mass and speed, and it bumps into the walls of the container and things like that. You would expect, right, if because those two things are different, you'd expect that there's some experiment you can do from outside the box that would tell a difference. In practice, you would be able to see the small fluctuations of the box because the particle is hitting into its walls and things like that. But suppose we happen to live in a universe where, our measurements are restricted in such a way that we can't do those kind of experiments, right? In every detail, every single experiment you do doesn't tell the difference between box A and box B. Then it seems like if that's true, and there really is this difference between the two boxes, then there's some sorts of conspiracy. You would have expected to be able to construct a measurement that can do that, but our measurements are only yielding coarse-grained information in just such a way that the difference between those two things is lost, right? So that may lead you to doubt that there really is a physical difference between those two boxes, right? So you can have a physical difference between two things that's completely undetectable, but that means that your measurements must be coarse-grained in just such a particular way to avoid revealing that difference. So that seems like something that you need to explain. I'm not going to say that whenever this happens, it's absolutely evil and you need to eliminate it from your theory, but it seems like when you found such a thing, explanation is called for. Why is it like this? All right, so in Sperkin's approach, we can apply the principle of contextuality to preparations. We can apply it to measurements. That's the traditional notion of contextuality. We can also apply it to transformations, but I'm just going to look at the preparation case of preparations and measurements. Preparations actually turns out to be the simpler case, so we're going to look at that. So the first thing we do is we can define an equivalence relation on preparation procedures in an operational theory. So I'll say that two preparations are equivalent, operationally equivalent, we might say, if whatever measurement and outcome of that measurement you consider, the probabilities predicted by the two preparations are the same. Any measurement you do, any measurement outcome you look at, always has the same probability. So, in particular, if you have a quantum model and it happens to be the case that they get assigned the same quantum state always predicts the same probabilities. So, in particular, if you have a model in which these preparations are represented by the same quantum state, then they're operationally equivalent like that. Well, no, because you could have an operational theory in which you're not doing every possible measurement that quantum theory allows, right? You could have an operational theory with some finite number of measurements. Say it's only got measurements that correspond to one orthonormal basis, right? You don't have all the rest. Then typically there's more than one quantum model that can reproduce the predictions of the operational theory. In that case, you wouldn't be able to detect coherences between states in that basis, right? So it could be the case that I actually assign two preparations different quantum states, but they're still operationally equivalent because my measurements are restricted in some way. Does that make sense? Okay. But in particular, this implication holds. So we say that the model is preparation non-contextual if operational equivalence means that the two epistemic states are the same. In other words, whenever there's absolutely no observable distinction between two preparations operationally, they get represented the same way in the ontological model, the same epistemic state. So we take the fact that there's no observational difference between them as evidence that there ought to be no difference between them. Right, so this is basically the application of the Leibniz principle here. If two things look the same, they are the same. So a model that's not preparation non-contextual is obviously called preparation contextual. Okay, so there's one other thing we need, which is the idea that in general you can mix preparations. So if an operational theory contains two preparations P and Q, then we can construct a mixed preparation, which I'll denote P, P plus 1 minus PQ. And physically what this means is just toss a coin. Ignore the system, toss a coin, which has probability of heads P. Do preparation P if it lands heads, do preparation Q if it lands tails, and then forget the outcome of the coin toss, okay? So that will give you operational predictions that are just the mixture of the corresponding mixture of the two, of what you get from the two preparations. So we assume that the ontological model actually preserves mixtures in the same sense, right? So when I do this mixed preparation, I really just get the mixture of the two epistemic states. So that looks like, it's a very natural assumption, of course, and it's kind of a mild assumption. If you want to doubt it, you can actually show that it is an instance of preparation non-contextuality. Because if I apply preparation non-contextuality now to the physical system I'm measuring and the coin as a joint system, then doing this mixed preparation and then conditioning on the outcome of the coin is a way of doing a preparation that's operationally equivalent to P or Q, depending on what I condition on. And if those have to be the same epistemic state, then the mixture has to be this. Anyway, but that's not very important. The only important thing is that this is a natural requirement to have on mixed preparations. Yeah.
So you have a P and a Q, which are preparations.
Yeah.
And now you're suddenly summing stuff.
Yeah, so this just means, this is just code. I mean, I'm not saying that these things form a ring or a field or anything like that necessarily, although you could construct such a thing. You can construct such a thing in quantum logic and things like that. I'm not claiming that there. I'm just using this as a notation for that.
For what exactly?
For doing this physically. For this procedure. So when I write down this preparation procedure, I mean physically you did this. So it's a preparation procedure, which is is a way of generating another preparation procedure from two, or you could generalize it, of course, or more preparations.
And how is that equation then not trivial?
This one?
Yeah.
Well, what's trivial is the operational equation, prob k given p m. Right, so this is obviously going to be true operationally, given p p.
What do you mean operationally? You're talking about probability.
I mean, this is what's going to happen. But you might imagine, like, in ontological models have to already be so strange for many reasons. You might imagine something very strange happens. You might imagine that the fact that I flipped a coin somehow interferes with the system. Right? You might imagine that somehow the properties of the coin influence the properties of the system in some way. Right? So then, you might say that, okay, flipping a coin, getting heads, and doing P doesn't prepare the same thing as just doing P on its own. That would be a very conspiratorial thing to suggest, but it's possible, right? It's possible in principle.
I think what I don't understand is, like, you can talk about whatever philosophy you want, but in the end, this is an equation with probabilities, which you can check.
Yes, but this is true by definition of the mix. This is true by definition of the mixed preparation. This is not necessarily true because physically, I might imagine that flip coin do P is not the same as do P.
Because right? That's not
they're physically different things. Whether I flipped a coin or not is, you know, those are two physically distinct scenarios. So I might imagine that preparation actually prepares a different probability distribution over the ontic states, and then I wouldn't have this equation. That would be a highly contextual theory, of course, but we're considering proofs of contextual.
Any probability with a lambda in it is something you can't test observationally.
Yeah, you can't see it operation.
That's not a statement. That can
well,
be
not
checked.
Directly anyway.
It's an assumption.
We can talk about it later, but for now we're going to make this assumption. Okay, so now let's prove that an ontological model for a qubit can't be preparation non-contextual. I must be preparation contextual, by the way, we can only show that for mixed states, right? So what we can show is that preparations of mixed states must be preparation contextual. Okay, so what we're going to do is consider this sort of Star of David type of formulation on the Bloch sphere. So the states labeled with a small letter and a big letter, those are orthogonal to each other. So little a is orthogonal to big A, and because it's difficult to see a difference between little c and big C, I'm putting these serifs on the big C here. Okay, so this implies that the supports of the probability distributions representing these things must have trivial intersections. So the orthogonal states have trivial intersection of their supports, where this is the support of the corresponding probability distribution. Why is that? Well, from the lemma, we know that the support is a subset of this thing, which is the set of things that give you probability, the set of lambda that give you probability 1 when you measure something that includes psi. So if we do a orthonormal basis measurement with these two, then we also know that the probabilities must sum to 1 for all lambda. That's probability distribution over A, little a and big A. So wherever this guy is 1, this guy has to be 0, and vice versa. So that means that there's no intersection between these two sets for orthogonal states. But then because we also know that the supports are subsets of that, there can be no intersection of those either. Right, is that clear? Okay, so we know that these orthogonal pairs, the corresponding probability distributions in the ontological model will have no overlap. Okay, so we also have the following operational equivalences. The maximally mixed state, which is in the center here, is an equal mixture of each of these orthogonal pairs. But also because this is an equilateral triangle and this is an equilateral triangle, if I do an equal mixture of the little a, little b, little c, or big A, big B, big C, those also give me the maximally mixed state. Okay, so maximally mixed state, that means that those are operationally equivalent preparation procedures. So if I prepare this with probability half and this with probability half, that's operationally equivalent to all of these other ways of doing it. So in a non-contextual model, all of those have to give me the same probability distribution over lambda. So the three orthogonal pairs are going to give me these three equations, and these triple mixtures are going to give me these two equations. So all of those have to give me the same probability distribution over ontic states. All right, so now let's look at these two sets of equations. Because of the orthogonality, any lambda that I pick can be in most at most one of these two, right? It needn't be the case that these two sets exhaust the entire space, by the way, right? They could be ontic states that are not prepared when I prepare little a, not prepared when I prepare big A, but are prepared when I prepare some other state. Okay, so for each of the A, B, C, you can only either be in the little space or the big space or outside both of them. Okay. So let's, in particular, choose a lambda that's not in little a space, not in the little b space, and not in the big C space. Okay, so in that case, I know that the probability of a lambda given little a is zero, the probability of lambda given little b is zero, probability of lambda given big C is zero. So we can just look at this equation down here, and I say, okay, for that particular lambda, this is zero. So for that particular lambda, I just get this from this equation down here. Over here, from this equation up here, I know that these two are zero, so I get this. Right, so if I compare these two equations, I see that for this particular lambda, I've got an equation like this, which is only solution is zero. So I assign zero probability to that lambda in the maximally mixed state. Now, what you can do is make every possible choice of not being in one of these sets. Okay, so there are 2 × 2 × 2, 8 possible choices. For each of those choices, you can, in a very similar way, get a contradiction. Okay, but each of those choices exhausts all of lambda. Like when I take the union of those sets, that's the whole of lambda. So that means that I'll end up having derived that this probability has to be zero everywhere on lambda, but it's supposed to be a probability distribution. Therefore, this cannot be true. So that shows you that the preparation non-contextuality assumption is ruled out. Is that clear how that works? Blank faces, so I'll assume that means yes. Okay. So preparation non-contextuality you can't have even for a qubit. So now let's do the same thing with measurements. It should be clear how we're going to do this now. I'm going to define an equivalence relation on pairs, which consists of a measurement and one of the outcomes of that measurement. Okay, so M has an outcome K, N has an outcome L. And I'll say that if, for all possible ways of preparing the system, they give me the same probability always, then that's what I mean by operationally equivalent measurement outcome pairs. In particular, if they happen to correspond to the same POVM element, then as we had with states, they will, oh, that should be an N on that side. Then they'll be operationally equivalent. So similarly, we'll say that the ontological model is measurement non-contextual if operational equivalence implies that the response functions of those measurement outcome pairs as functions of lambda are the same everywhere. So it's the same sort of idea. No physical way of distinguishing the two measurement outcome pairs means they should be the same in the ontological model. And that should say measurement. See, I need to not be finishing my slides so late at night. Okay, so a model that's not measurement is not measurement non-contextual is measurement contextual. Okay, so first of all, there's absolutely no hope whatsoever of proving measurement contextuality in this sense, because we've already seen a model that satisfies this definition. It was the Beltrametti-Lugacsky model, the one that models orthodox quantum mechanics. Because in that model, remember, when you do a pure state preparation, you end up with just that as the ontic state, and the probabilities for measurement outcomes are just then the quantum probabilities. Quantum probabilities are non-contextual in this sense. You can see they only depend on the POVM element. Okay, so that's going to give you a non-contextual model. Okay, so people still bother with this. So what you can do is you have to make an additional assumption in order to rule something out. And this brings us to the original Cochin-Specker definition of contextuality. So in the original 1967 paper, Cochin-Specker had a definition which is equivalent to this. So first of all, this notion only applies to projective measurements. Okay, so in the old days, people weren't considering POVMs, just projective measurements. This is only supposed to be applied to such things. The model should be measurement non-contextual in this sense, assign the same indicator functions, and assign the same response functions, and also outcome deterministic. Okay, so there's an additional assumption which says that every projector, you know, your ontic state should assign a definite outcome to every measurement. So every projector gets value 0 or 1. Okay, so that you might think, I certainly think that's kind of a lousy assumption. Why would you care about that? So in some sense, Cochin-Specker contextuality is, for me, a little bit less interesting. However, remember that hierarchy that I showed you earlier. In some sense, proving that something is chaos contextual allows you to imply that it's preparation contextual. So in some sense, it is still proving something that's mathematically stronger. And it's interesting, certainly, in the context of reality of the wave function studies. And lots of people still study this. OK, so it's a bit like Gleason's theorem that I mentioned in, I think it was about lecture 2 or so. This can only be proved in Hilbert space dimension greater than or equal to 3. However, you can do something that's a bit hybrid, and Rob Speckens showed how to do this. If we apply this KS definition, including the outcome determinism for projective measurements, but for POVMs, allow POVMs in the model, for POVMs we don't require the determinism, just this definition, then you can, using POVMs, prove this Speckenstar contextuality for measurements in dimension 2 as well. So I'm not going to do that proof because it's very similar to the preparation contextuality proof. You can look it up in Rob's paper if you're interested in the details. I'm going to focus on standard proofs of KS contextuality because they're going to be relevant and useful for other things. Okay, so this is not how non-contextuality is always presented. So I want to give you the idea of how you connect it to some of the other ways it's presented. So due to the outcome determinism assumption, each lambda determines, we can think of each lambda as determining a value function, right? You can think of lambda as a value function if you like. It has to assign a value 0 or 1 to each projector, right, which are these probability indicator functions. But just think of that as a function that's assigning values 0 and 1. Now, since probabilities, when you sum over a projective measurement, have to sum to 1, that means that in each projective measurement, in each set of orthogonal projectors, exactly one of the projectors must get assigned value 1, and the rest must get assigned a value 0, because you need these things to be probabilities. So then we can also think of the value functions as assigning definite values to observables, like self-adjoint operators, by basically saying, well, in this kind of thing, right? So you write your observable in its eigendecomposition, and the projector that gets assigned value 1, you say that the observable gets the corresponding eigenvalue, right? So we just assign two observables, the eigenvalue corresponding to the projector that's assigned value 1. And then if you have two observables that commute with each other, then you know that they have a joint eigen decomposition. So there's some common set of projectors in which I can write these two things in their spectral decomposition. And then you have that because these projectors are orthogonal, the product is just take the products of the eigenvalues and put that with the corresponding projector, and the sum is just take the sum of the eigenvalues and put that with the corresponding projector. Okay, so in all of these decompositions, one of these projectors, the value function gives 1 and the rest 0. So the value functions are just going to obey the same algebra as the eigenvalues do, right? So the eigenvalue of Mn that gets assigned is just the eigenvalue of M that gets assigned times the value of N that gets assigned, because it's just one of these j's, whichever one of these j's, and then the corresponding eigenvalue is this. So that holds when they commute, right? We need to have this common eigen decomposition. Then if you, in the sort of standard way, define what you mean by a function of an operator in terms of power series, then if we have the product and then we have the sum, that means, you know, those power series are all going to be written down in terms of products and sums like that. That means that if you have a set of operators that all mutually commute, then the value of the function of the operators is the function of the values of the operators. So another way of defining Cauchy Speck and contextuality and how it's often done is to say that there exists some value function that assigns eigenvalues to all observables and obeys this functional principle here, this one, only for observables that all mutually commute. Okay, so original proof of Cauchy-Speicher contextuality was very complicated, involving, I think it was 117 vectors or something like that. We since have much better ones, and this is probably the most popular proof of Cauchy-Speicher contextuality. It's called the Perez-Merman square. What we do is we consider these 9 observables here. These are Pauli observables on 2 qubits, and then we note that each row and each column consists of observables that mutually commute with one another. Okay, so because that's true, the value functions, if I take the product of a row, that gives me some observable, and the value assigned to that product should be just the products of the values of the individual elements. Okay, so that's true for every row and for every column. And then you compute those products, and they're just proportional to the identity operators. All of them are plus the identity operator except this one. These three, when you take their product, gives you minus the identity operator. Okay, so each of these observables in this table has eigenvalue either plus or minus, eigenvalues plus or minus 1. So the value it receives has to be plus or minus 1. Each row and column, as I said, consists of mutually commuting observables. Now let's look at the columns, right? So because this is the identity is always going to receive value 1, right? If I measure the identity operator, it only has one eigenvalue. I always get that, it's plus 1. So the identity operator has to get value plus 1, and that means that if the products of these values are going to be plus 1, then there has to be an even number of minus 1s here. So either no minus 1s or 2 minus 1s. Okay? So that's true for each column. So in total, by analyzing the columns, we see that there must be an even number of minus 1s in this table for values. Now we'll do the same thing for the rows. There must be an even number of minus 1s here, an even number of minus 1s here, but these guys have to multiply to minus the identity, which only has one eigenvalue, minus 1. So these guys have to multiply to minus 1, so there has to be an odd number of minus 1s here. So you get even plus odd, that's an odd number, and this way you get even, plus even, which is an even number. So there has to both be an even number of minus 1s in the table and an odd number of minus 1s in the table, which is impossible. So that shows you that there's a contradiction. You can't assign values in this way. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, I think we'll stop here for now. Beginning of next time, I'm going to show you a slightly different way of looking at how to prove these kinds of contextuality things.